heard Doug from behind me say, "I'm dying, I've been hit." I looked back only to see him covered in blood. I got out of the vehicle, guns were pointed at me, and I just prayed and just said thank you, you know, thinking this was my last few moments on earth and that, you know, I was hoping that God would show some mercy on me.
The cathedral at Notre Dame goes up in flames. Was it an accident? And more about the ambush in Haiti last week of American missionaries, coming up on today's Hot Zone.
This is the Hot Zone. Engaging with the news in a whole new way, international war correspondent Chuck Holton brings insight into areas of crisis and lets you help those affected.
Hey folks, yesterday the world watched in shock as the historic cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris burned. And it's been wall-to-wall coverage about it on the mainstream news, so I don't really need to spend a lot of time talking about what happened or what it looked like, but I think I felt like we should at least touch on it here. So far, it's being ruled an accident, and I sincerely hope it is. Now, I'm not going to speculate on whether or not it was intentional, because I don't want this show to be about conspiracy theories. There are plenty of those out there. But what I do want to talk about is context, something that's often sorely lacking in the mainstream media. The context surrounding the burning of one of the most high-profile cathedrals in France, and I dare say the world, the week right before Easter, is this. France is suffering from a crime wave of attacks and vandalism aimed at its Christian churches. There are thousands of them across that country. In 2018, it saw over 1,000 attacks, from cathedrals being spray-painted to crosses and statues being smashed to other churches that caught on fire as well. Just last month, the famous Saint-Sulpice Church was set ablaze during a service. That's the one you might remember that they used to film a Dan Brown movie. And so it's very well-known, very beautiful church. Now, all this may or may not be an intentional jihad against the influence of Christianity in France, such as it is. In reality, while more than 50% of Frenchmen self-identify as Catholic or Protestant, the truth is only 5% of them are practicing their faith. By way of contrast, 12% of the French population are practicing Muslims. So there are more than twice as many devout followers of Muhammad in France as there are devout followers of Christ. All that says is that the culture is shifting very, very quickly away from Christian ideology. It's now much more hostile to all things Christian than it's ever been since Christianity first came to France when Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne as emperor of the Holy Roman Empire in the year 800. So the fact that we're seeing an average of 2 hostile acts against the Catholic churches in France every day is hardly surprising. So too is the fact that many churches and cathedrals are simply shutting their doors for lack of parishioners, with many reopening as cafes and dance clubs or private homes. Now, I just want to stop and just make very clear once again that I'm not saying that this attack yesterday had to do with Muslim terrorists. We don't know that. They're doing a very big investigation. There will be an incredibly thorough investigation into this, and we'll find out what they know, hopefully, before too long. But it is important to point out that France has been very reticent to even name things that they know have to do with Islamic terrorism or fundamentalism as such, because they just don't want to further anger the people within their borders. And I guess in some sense, that's understandable from the government. In another sense, it kind of smacks of political correctness, and it makes me sick. As for terrorism, anything associated with Christianity across Europe is a target. There's no question about that. The 2017 investigation into the Algerian jihadi who ran down and killed 13 people in Barcelona, that investigation uncovered a plot to blow up what is probably the most well-known cathedral in Spain, the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. Now, that attack also shed more light on other terrorist plans to attack churches across Europe, which I reported on just over a year ago on my trip to Germany.
In August of last year, 14 people were murdered in Barcelona, Spain, in an ISIS-inspired terror attack, and we were there to cover that. One of the men arrested in that attack told investigators that ISIS is also planning other attacks across Europe, especially on churches and monuments like this one. This is the Frauenkirche in Dresden, Germany. And it was featured on the front page of ISIS recruiting magazine called Rumia a few months ago. They said that this is a perfect place to attack because it's where crusaders like to gather, and it's there just waiting to be burned down. And that's especially brutal because this church was just rebuilt in 2004 after being firebombed in World War II. So it just is another illustration of why it's so important for Europe to get a handle on this issue of mass migration and the extremist ideology of ISIS and the people that could use that flow of migrants to come into Europe and use it to cause harm.
So while this latest tragedy involving an iconic cathedral in France might or might not have been linked to criminal activity, the stark reality is that there's a bigger problem with the churches in France. There's a bigger problem with Christianity in France, and indeed Christianity across Europe. And that is that they're under attack and have been for a long, long time, not just from radical jihadist terrorists, although that is a problem. They're under attack from their own people, in as much as the government is moving very quickly away from the foundations that Europe was built on. Last summer, I was fortunate to be able to take my daughter to my daughter Amy, my youngest daughter, to Europe for a couple of weeks. And we visited many of the sacred and historic sites there. We got to go to the Vatican in Rome. And we had a chance also to visit the site of a major terror attack in Nice, France, on the second anniversary of the attack, Bastille Day, and witnessed a spectacular memorial service that night.
So it's Bastille Day here in France, and millions of people across the country are gearing up for huge celebrations that will happen today. You can imagine there's still a pretty massive terror threat when you have these kind of crowds gathering around the country. And for that reason, the police and the military are out in force. In Paris alone, they've deployed 12,000 police officers, and they've got special operations police on every train running in the country. And that's because they know that that threat is real. The French government has actually done a pretty good job of cracking down on the terrorists. As a matter of fact, in 2016, we saw an attack virtually every month. And so far this year, we've only had two terror attacks, and that comes down to two things. Number one, the government has gotten much better at thwarting attacks. We've had quite a few thwarted attacks in the last year. And number two, the United States and other countries have done a good job of just decimating ISIS across the globe. But the bottom line is, today is the two-year anniversary of the huge terror attack that took place in the south of France, in Nice, where a terrorist plowed into a crowd of people like this one behind me and killed more than 80 and wounded almost 500.
I wanted to see the place where the attack happened. And since it was the two-year anniversary, I jumped in my car and drove 10 hours from Paris to Nice to see the celebrations and to see what kind of memorial they had planned for the second anniversary of the attack. I was the only American journalist in attendance.
Just to give you an idea of how on edge this city is, here in Nice just a few days ago at a soccer game, somebody let off some sparklers and it caused a stampede and 27 people were taken to the hospital. It just goes to show that people still don't feel very safe here because they know that they're still a target. So this is the city of Nice. This is the promenade along the beach in the south of France, right along the Mediterranean. This place used to be famous just for its beautiful beaches and beautiful women, but now it's infamous for the tragedy that took place right here about this time 2 years ago tonight on Bastille Day, as a madman drove a 19-ton cargo truck right through this crowd and murdered scores of people. But there's a lot of security here tonight for obvious reasons, and they've made other changes as well, like the bollards that are posted along this road to make sure that something like that will never happen here ever again.
The memorial began with 86 giant spotlights and 86 balloons for each of those killed in the attack. They reached into the night sky, and the crowd fell silent in remembrance. Some shed tears. It was a sobering reminder that evil men are out there, waiting to destroy our way of life. It's also a reminder that we must be prepared to confront that evil when it comes. We also spent a fun couple of hours walking around Notre Dame, and I'm so glad that we did. I've been there many times since my first trip in 1987, and I feel so blessed to have visited it with both of my daughters now. But the one thing I've noticed between my first trip to Europe as a wide-eyed 17-year-old kid right out of high school, and now with my almost 17-year-old daughter, is that Europe is changing, and it's changing fast. If you want to go see those monuments and those historical sites, I suggest you plan to do it sooner rather than later. If you don't, that cathedral you wanted to visit might be covered up with graffiti by the time you get there, or God forbid, turned into a nightclub. Let's go on to other news. Yesterday, I talked about the missionary doctor who was ambushed and shot in a tragic incident during a short-term mission trip to Haiti last week. Thankfully, that doctor survived his 3 gunshot wounds, at least 2 of which should have been fatal. And even more miraculously, he was only 1 out of 6 missionaries in that convoy who was hit by a barrage of gunfire. I had the privilege yesterday to talk to him as he was still recovering in the hospital. And I also got to talk to the man who was driving the doctor, driving the vehicle the doctor was riding in, a guy named Drew Passler. Drew agreed to come on the show and talk about it. So Drew, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, so myself and 6 other missionaries from South Florida, we were going to the northwest of Haiti just like we've done on our previous trips. We were transporting about $20,000 worth of computer equipment that we had donated from some benefactors at Microsoft to help build out a state-of-the-art computer lab in the northwest in the school that we've constructed over the past 2 years and hoping to change the entire northwest. The only thing different with this trip is on our trip about 30 to 40 minutes north of St. Mark, we encountered what seemed to be a typical roadblock, which we have in the past. Typically, they'll ask for money or, you know, medication for their kids, stuff like that. The difference was is that there was a fire burning in the road here. And as the vehicle in front of us, a Toyota Land Cruiser, we were following in a Toyota Hilux pickup truck, I saw as they approached, there was about 100 people that started pouring in from the sides of the roads and swarming this vehicle, and it was fully engulfed within seconds. So we stopped our truck at that point to assess the situation, and that's when I saw an individual come around the side of their vehicle with a long rifle. At that point, we decided that we didn't know what the situation was, and regardless, we needed to get out of there. I started to reverse the vehicle. And in the process of going in reverse, they started to fire shots at our vehicle. At first, it was just 1, and then it was 2 people, and I could hear the shots hitting the bumper, the front of the vehicle, and the hood. When I was about 300 yards away from the vehicle, I decided to try to make a K-turn to get the vehicle around and at least have the back of the truck that was loaded behind us to protect us so we could try to get away. In the process of turning around the vehicle, they shot out the rear tire of the vehicle, and with a full load damage to the engine, we were only able to go about 5 or 6 miles an hour. So we weren't moving fast, but we were gaining some distance between them. But what we didn't realize was that there were people coming up behind us, not only on foot, but also there was 2 Haitian men on a motorcycle, the passenger carrying a machine gun. And he pulled up along the driver's side of the vehicle and opened fire. And that's when I heard the window behind my head blow out and continued to hear a barrage of shots. It was seconds after that that I heard Doug from behind me say, "I'm dying, I've been hit." I looked back only to see him covered in blood. So not knowing what else to do at this point and knowing that we could not run these guys with a machine gun, I stopped the vehicle, hoping that maybe they would take mercy on us and allow us to tend to our friend. I got out of the vehicle, guns were pointed at me, and I just prayed and just said thank you, you know, thinking this was my last few moments on earth and that, you know, I was hoping that God would show some mercy on me. They started to loot us at that point. They took my cell phone, my sunglasses, they took my backpack from the truck and started looking to see what was in our cargo. They started looting our other members of our team, and I watched one of the members from the Haitian gang stick a rifle into the back window of the truck and put it to Doug's head, attempting to, you know, for lack of better words, finish him off, seeing that he was sitting in the seat suffering, covered in his own blood. At that point, you know, I didn't really know what was going to happen. And it wasn't short after that that our other members of our truck had come around the front and were trying to talk to them and tell them that, you know, our friend's dying. We need to get to a hospital. We're there to help the kids. And within seconds, just this man appeared out of nowhere on a motorcycle and positioned himself between me and the gunman on a motorcycle. And he stopped there and he raised his left hand and put his right hand on my right arm. And, you know, and he looked at me and he just said, "It's okay. It's going to be okay." And he said something in two or three words in Creole. And these men just stopped what they were doing. And it was really bizarre because the situation just de-escalated extremely quickly. And it allowed us the time to get to our friend and tend to him to get him into our other vehicle. By the time I made it to the back seat of the truck, you know, in a couple seconds, I turned around to say thank you to the man on the motorcycle, and he was nowhere to be found. That's when I could see our other truck approaching us, and I knew that we didn't have much time. We needed to get him into that vehicle and get out of that situation as fast as possible. Fred from our truck decided to stay with that the broken down truck and one of the Haitian workers we had with us to repair the tire and, you know, at least ensure that the goods in our truck stayed safe, knowing that, you know, the gunmen were gone at that moment. And we piled into the Toyota Land Cruiser to rush Doug to the closest hospital in St. Mark, which was 30 to 40 minutes away. You know, shortly, you know, on the route there, we worked to try to call the U.S. Embassy to get transport to Port-au-Prince and get out of the country, or at least get Doug medevaced. But in the route, Doug actually asked me to record his, you know, his last words to his family, not thinking he was going to make it.
"Honey, I just want you to know I love you, and I love you, Michael. Michael, I want you to be a pilot. Don't ever give up that dream. Leave for the war. Anyway, I love you.
I love you both. So it was an unbelievably emotional, you know, roller coaster of feelings and emotions this entire time. Getting to the hospital, you know, it was great because we knew we can get him into some better care, but it wasn't much of a hospital compared to what we're used to here in the States. And Doug was suffering and he was in quite a bit of pain. So it was quite the ordeal, you know, especially for a trip of six people trying to just help some Haitian children and try to change the Northwest.
Yeah, day one in Haiti. Do you've talked with the other guys that were there. Do you have any sense of what this was about? Were they just robbers or was it a gang or what was it?
So from my understanding, you know, in the following 2 days that we spent in Haiti and the process trying to get out of there, what we understand is that this was a gang. It wasn't a political uprising, which has happened in the past. And it was a gang that's been pushed out of Port-au-Prince, and the gang had relocated to the gang leader's hometown, which was this city north of St. Mark. They've actually continued to set up roadblocks in that area, and I've heard reports of four other individuals have been shot and killed by these individuals since our last trip. So it's actually considered a level 4 area. They're saying they don't want any travel into there, but this is a gang. The police have tried to actually mitigate the situation, only to have lost two of their own in a firefight the evening actually following our event. And I don't know that they've gone back yet, but it is an ongoing issue that they're trying to deal with, and it is causing quite a bit of problems in that region.
What was your first conversation with your family like?
My first conversation with my family was honestly probably the most difficult, to try to explain to my mom that I'm okay and not to worry, which is obviously not the thing you're going to try to tell your mother after you've just been shot at. But I told her that, you know, my life's in God's hands now, and, you know, he's taken care of me so far. So, you know, I just need you to trust too, and just, you know, have some prayers and pray for our safe return and to pray for Doug and her and my rest of my family and our local hometown church. They did just that, and I think that's big part of how we all made it back home safe.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, I'd like to talk to you more about this and especially talk to Doug about it when he gets able, and maybe some of the other guys. So next week I'm coming to Florida. I've already talked to Doug about it, and I'm going to come sit down with you and get the full story. But I just wanted to give our viewers a taste of this. We also want to encourage people to go to the GoFundMe page that's been set up to help defray the cost of Doug's care. I'll put that in the end notes of this show, and we'll encourage people on Facebook and social media to go and contribute to that, because I know he's going to need it. He's going to be have a long road to recovery back. What are your plans concerning Haiti? You think you'll ever go back?
Absolutely. I actually just had a meeting this evening prior to this call with all the members, the board members of Living Waters. I've actually started a nonprofit of my own. I plan on going back in the next few months. I do need to get these computers set up. It was a mission put on my heart by God to do this. And, you know, I've never not completed something I've set out to do. So I'm going to make this happen one way or the other.
Well, Drew, you're definitely my kind of guy, and it's great to meet you and get a chance to talk to you finally about this. And I look forward to seeing you late next week to do that as well. So, folks, that's it for today's show. We're out of time. There's so much more to this story, and we're going to tell you more about it. This is something that you're not seeing on the mainstream media, and you're not. This is an exclusive interview for today. So, I really appreciate it, Drew. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely, thank you, Chuck.
Absolutely, thank you, Chuck. I appreciate your time.
God bless you. Fantastic. Well, thanks for being on the show, and thank you for watching today. Those of you who are following the podcast, I just beg you to go and like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to it, whether that's Facebook or YouTube or iTunes or Podbean or any other outlet. OpsLens is a great place to watch the show. Just go to OpsLens.com and click on the Hot Zone link there to watch the show, because there's so much great video. And listen, I'm putting a lot of work into editing this thing, so it'll be a good TV show, not just a good podcast. But if you're listening to the podcast, that's great, and I appreciate you doing it, because it enables us to stay doing what we love and to bring you the news from kind of behind the scenes and to bring you stuff that you're not going to see on the mainstream media like you saw today. And look for more of that tomorrow. This is Chuck Holton, and you've been listening to The Hot Zone.
The Hot Zone is produced by Amy Holton and Livefire Media. Copyright 2019.